Welcome to this edition of the Golf Central Podcast presented by Callaway Golf. I'm Ryan Ladner, soon to be joined by Rex Hoggart. It is the third week of January, and finally, we have a full slate of activity. The PGA Tour back on the mainland with the American Express in Palm Springs. Rex is there. He'll give us some on-the-ground reporting. Abu Dhabi on the DP World Tour kicks off with Rory McIlroy making his 2020 debut. Kyle Morikawa, the world number two, has yet another opportunity to rise to that top spot. LPGA Tour begins. PGA Tour Champions begins. Corn Ferry Tour begins. Latin America Amateur Championship with a spot in the Masters up for grabs. It is a very busy week. We're going to break it all down on this week's podcast. But first, Callaway's new Rogue ST drivers are their fastest, most stable drivers ever, with four head shapes to fit every type of player. Their industry-leading innovations include an all-new tungsten speed cartridge, jailbreak speed frame, and an AI-designed flash face for maximum speed with exceptional levels of forgiveness. And these drivers are already off to a great start on tour for players like the world number one Jon Rahm, Xander Schauffele, Kevin Kisner, and Phil Mickelson. Rogue ST drivers are available for pre-order on Friday. Go to CallawayGolf.com now to learn more. Rex, it sounds like I'm going to need to get my hands on one of those drivers. Desperate need, my friend. 10.5 degree stiff shaft. You think we can make it happen? Rex, you think we can make it happen?
I'll pass it along. I'll see what I can do.
Love to hear that. Rex, you're in Palm Springs. This is a tournament that is near and dear to my heart. Used to cover this all the time when I was a young pro coming up at Golf Week and then the early years of my stint at golfchannel.com. My grandparents used to live in Rancho Mirage. I would vacation every year, either during spring break or during the Christmas holiday to visit them. I love the snow-capped mountains, the 70-degree sun-bathed afternoons, and then the very chilly evenings. It gets real cold real quick once that sun disappears behind the mountains.
It really does, and what really takes you, and I've been here in July, and it's awful, so I kind of understand
why. Oh, absolutely toasty.
Yes, yes. I understand why people do it the way they do.
Grandpa used to love it.
Yes, they stay here in the cold months and then go back to wherever it is they're from in July and June when it's a million degrees here. I found it interesting, and I love this tournament as well. I'm probably not as emotionally invested as you are, but I was going on Golf Today, and Damon and Shane were having an extended conversation before my hit came up. And normally, you and I can both attest to this, again, pulling the curtain back a little bit. Like, you're really not listening to what's going on in the broadcast because you're thinking about
We're just trying not to screw up.
That's right. I'm trying to stay in between the lanes. I'm trying not to mess up. I'm trying to make sure I do whatever it is I have to do correctly. And they went on a 10-minute, I mean, I'm going to call it a tirade. And it was a solid 10-minute tirade. And the question was, is the game too easy? Of course it's not too easy for you.
Is pro golf too easy was the question.
Is pro golf too easy is what they were getting into. And this goes back to Maui, and you and I have addressed this. And right out of that conversation, they pulled me up. And my only response was, wow, you guys are not going to be happy this week because these guys are going to destroy these golf courses. And I pointed out that
Laquinta is so easy.
It's back in the rotation. They didn't even play Laquinta last year because there was no amateur competition here. So now they've taken the course where at least one of the 259s that have been shot in this tournament was shot, and they've put it back in. It's going to be perfect. It's golf in the dome. And again, I go back to the idea. It may be too easy for the pros on certain conditions, on certain courses, but are you not entertained, man? Like, what is wrong with birdies? I don't get this.
I mean, who cares? They're really easy golf courses. There's no rough. There's a rare exception during this tournament week where you actually get a bunch of win. We've seen that the last couple of years. I mean, Patrick Reed hit 30 under par a couple years ago. I remember that Patrick Reed going deep there. I mean, La Quinta is one of the easiest golf courses. You're probably going to have a couple run-ins with 59 watches. Who cares? It's the early part of the year. We're going up against the NFL divisional playoff round. I mean, do you want to see guys shoot 25 under par vying for the title with Jon Rahm and Patrick Cantlay in a really good field that's actually assembled this week at the Amex? Or do you want to see guys slug it out at 12 under par? Third week of January, guys still knocking off the rust. First full field event on the mainland. I want to see birdies. I want to be entertained.
want to be entertained. And look, we go to Toy Pines next week. You'll be at Toy Pines next week. There's nothing easy.
Brutish.
I mean, and look, the North course is marginally easier than the South course in that rotation. However, it's not easy. Like, I love the North course, and it is not an easy golf course. And soon enough, we'll be at Bay Hill. We'll be at the Honda Classic. We'll be at the Players Championship. There's going to be plenty.
And then
of
everyone, and then what does everyone say, Rex? When the Florida Swing comes along, this isn't a very good prep for the Masters. This is too difficult.
Why would we do this? I don't understand. It was funny. Scottie Scheffler came to the media center today, and he was asked about it, and he had the same reaction. That, look, if you don't like watching us make birdies, I understand that. But the fact of the matter is, if you put any of us tour professionals on a golf course where there's no wind, and there's not going to be any wind this week, it's going to be in the mid to low 70s, and we're in the desert. Of course, there's not going to be any rain. Guys are going to destroy those golf courses. And I'm kind of looking forward to the idea that I have to pay attention to rounds, because you're right. I guarantee at one point this week, Golf Channel is going to put the 59th scroll up. It's got to go up. Over under, at least once, right?
I would say 1.5 times you're going to have a 59 watch. I mean, that's just the nature of these three golf courses. It's the nature of this tournament. You know, you're going to have to shoot mid to upper 20s to have a realistic chance to win this golf tournament. I always chuckle when people say, like, oh, is professional golf too easy? And you're right. Like, no wind, easy golf courses, no rough, soft greens. Just perfectly scoreable conditions. Of course, they're going to light it up. It's like for us, if you give us good quotes, if you give us a great scene that we can lead our story with, if we can somehow rack our brains and think of a good kicker, no, none of us say like, "Ooh, is writing too easy?"
That's
like,
too easy.
Oh,
yeah.
I wrote a good story. Is writing too easy? No, there was a perfect confluence of events that allowed us to write a good story.
Have you ever said that?
We had a good scene. We had a good kicker. What else do you want us to do? It's not. I promise it's not too easy. We just so happen to make it work.
I've never said that. I've sat down and written a million stories over my lifetime. There have been some that are easier than others, but I've never kind of just taken a deep breath and went, whew, man,
that was
like mailing it in.
I mean, you can tell on major Sundays if I have the goods or not, because I can usually get the game story done, which is going to be about 2,000 words. If I can get it right around that 2.5 hour mark, like, that's kind of the sweet spot for me. I'm really cruising if I can pump out 2,000 words, good words, in 2.5 hours. If it's taking me longer than that,
it's not
transitions aren't coming easily. I'm struggling with a couple nut graphs. I'm not real pleased with my lead, but certainly some stories are easier than others.
I feel like the PGA Championship last year was one of those that was not so easy for you. I walked out of that media center, and I don't know that you were halfway done with your story. Now, granted,
I had to do a TV hit in the middle.
You had to do
it.
A TV hit, but I think you were laboring over that one. If you're being honest,
and then I was getting killed on Twitter because I was accused of being a panic mongrel with the scene on the 72nd hole where Phil and apparently people were taking shots at Brooks. I was not fear mongering. I was not trying to incite panic among the masses. It was a chaotic scene for about a minute, and then order was restored once I safely galloped to the back of the 18th green. I was actually quite pleased, Rex, with that game story, and I actually believe I submitted that for the GWA writing contest.
We'll see.
I mean, some of those are they actually good stories, or are you just trying to go for the topic?
Like, going for the topic, because Phil, it was easy.
Yeah. Phil winning a major is easy. I also lead all golf journalists in honorable mentions in the writing contest. I think I have about 15 of them. The guys who did make it look easy, Rex, I do want to get on this before we turn our attention to this full slate of action across basically every major tour. Is this incredible duel that we had at the Sony Open? A guy who made it look very easy was Hideki Matsuyama. He now has 3 wins in his last 18 starts. A dude who very much did not make it look easy was Russell Henley. 5-shot lead heading into the back nine, burned the lip on the 72nd hole, and then really didn't stand a prayer in overtime. Found the fairway bunker off the tee, and Hideki hit what I'm calling right now on January 18th, will be top three shot of the year. 277 three wood. That was basically brush it in distance for about 2.5 feet. What was your takeaway? Henley's collapse or Matsuyama's back nine surge?
Our colleague Doug Ferguson, he works for the Associated Press, who does a marvelous job. At the end of every season, he does this really cool story. I always thought it was a great idea where he
Definitely. I agree.
The best clubs of the year, the best wedge shot that was hit on the PGA Tour, 9-iron, 8-iron, so on and so on. And I immediately texted him on Sunday night that, well, you have your 3-wood. And his text back to me was, we'll see. And I just kept thinking to myself, really, you think there's going to be one that's better than that in overtime? For the win, which is essentially a walk off, and his response was,
"Yeah, I mean, you're not gonna hole a 3-wood, so hitting it to 2.5 feet is about as good as it gets."
Well, he goes, "Well, he didn't have to make the putt," and I go, "Well, now you're defining the outcome based on
because his shot was so good that it forced his hand that he had to make birdie. He had to make, so of course he was going to go for it, Henley.
Yes, he was going to go for it. To answer your question." And I'm not going to call out any of my colleagues because I have so much respect for anyone who goes on air and talks about golf.
Go on.
But it can be challenging. But someone said, and I honestly can't even tell you who, that they felt like Russell played well on the back nine. And I remember my head snapped to the left to the point that I got like a pain in my neck that I had to get worked on before I got on the plane on Monday morning. He was one over. He played awful at a tournament where everyone was going low. And I just don't know why we don't have to be apologists for players. I think Russell Henley would be the first one, if he's being honest in his heart of hearts, will tell you, yes, I played awful coming down the stretch. I felt the pressure. He talked about it beforehand. I have a hard time sleeping on 54 hole leads. And clearly it was right there on the back nine. Let's just call it for what it is.
Yeah, he's definitely going to have a hard time sleeping after what was just an ugly collapse. I mean, the bogey on 11, he developed a two-way miss off the tee, missing both left and right. He was just kind of grinding to a halt with his caddy, going over course management decisions that probably for the previous 63 holes they had breezed through. I mean, all credit to him. He needed to make a handful of 10 footers just to stay in the lead heading into the 18th hole. But no, that was not a well-played 9 holes of golf for a guy who prior to that, had been inside the top three in both strokes gained approach and strokes gained putting. There was nothing to that finish that was encouraging in my eyes for Russell Henley. On the flip side, I think we need to talk about Hideki Matsuyama's evolution. This was a player who at the Masters snapped a 4-year winless drought in dramatic fashion. And look, it felt like a seminal moment, certainly for Japan, where this was their first male men's major champion. You could see the weight lifted off of Hideki Matsuyama afterward. But I think we're finally now starting to see the totality and the significance of that victory. And look, there's still a language barrier. We don't know Japanese. Hideki is still not yet comfortable speaking English in press conference settings. So the insight that we're able to glean is still quite minimal. But one of the quotes that he said afterward, Rex, I thought was really revealing. And he said this through a translator, but when he was asked how his life has changed, if at all, he said it has, because the pressure of not winning a major has been gone. To me, that was the most revealing thing Hideki has ever said. He is now unburdened. He is now unbothered. He is now unafraid of chasing after titles, whether it's at the Sony Open or again in a major championship. And I think that makes him really dangerous moving forward. He's still just 29 years old.
I think it does make him really dangerous going forward. And I think, and you and I talked about this on Riders Block on Sunday night. You should check it out. We're going to start doing it
nice
live
plug.
On Sunday night. You like that? Good plug. And on Wednesday evenings, early Thursday morning, whenever we can work out the timing on that to preview the tournament. But it was interesting. He led the field in strokes gained putting.
Never before has that happened.
It was 7.26 strokes in strokes gained putting. That's not a little bit. I mean, he had an unbelievable week. And this goes back to, and I think you connected the dots on this, Cameron Smith the week before in Maui. He led the field strokes gained off the tee, which is something that he hadn't done very often, if at all, I think, at that point. And I think the question you asked me is, which one of those things is sustainable? Do you expect to see Hideki leading strokes gained putting week in and week out on the PGA Tour?
I'm not sure either of those things is sustainable.
I don't think I trust either one of those things to happen. And look, I think both of them are very talented players. When you look at Cam Smith, he's going to continue to putt really well, and he's going to be a good player, and he's going to win again on the PGA Tour. There's no doubt about it. Hideki is on the other side. He's an unbelievable, magical ball striker. I mean, it is something to watch him hit the ball. The swing on the 18th tee in regulation, where he sort of channeled his inner Bryson, was a thing of beauty because, unlike Bryson,
perfectly straight.
This looked completely controlled, and it's impossible to hit that fairway if you're hitting it that far because of just the way it runs out and it's the way it curves. There's no way he should be able to have held that fairway. It was an unbelievable shot. That's what I expect from him. The putting, I did not expect. Now, that said, and I'm not setting myself up for this debate again, I still think he's a very good putter, as he proved at the Masters, which does require a modicum of putting, despite what you argue with me about on Ryder's block. And I will retract a little bit that, okay, maybe it's not the putting contest that it was, but you still need to know what you're doing on the greens. You still need to have some sort of control. You still have to have some sort of confidence. And
Isn't that true of every tournament? Of course, the winner is going to have to putt well that week, unless you're Justin Thomas.
I don't think it's true at every tournament.
Who has won tournaments while losing strokes gained putting.
I mean, I would argue there's plenty of tournaments. The Open Championship immediately comes to mind, just because
you better be a good lag putter.
Yeah, you better be a good lag putter, but you don't have to be an excellent putter. You don't have to be making all of those 6-footers for par that you look at. I think in Matsuyama's point, and to your point, he gets to this because of the confidence I think he got at the Masters. Because it was a major, I think it's just a byproduct, because he builds it up in his own mind. We build it up in our minds. But I think the fact that he was able to deliver on that stage, knowing what he knows about that golf course and knowing the questions that everyone has about his game, yes, I think that's the confidence that drove him forward to the Zozo Championship at the end of last year in the fall, and certainly this, you know, at the Sony Open.
There's always this hysteria. I don't even think it's unique to Hideki, where if a guy has a strength, which is one of his preeminent strengths, and that's clearly ball striking, if he happens to have a good putting week, the hysteria around that is, boy, if he figures out his putting, he's just going to be a world beater. And look, Hideki Matsuyama had the week of his life on the greens. He ended up winning his 8th PGA Tour title. However, you can say that about at least a half dozen guys who are at the elite level of the PGA Tour, where if they just have a good putting week, they're probably going to win the tournament. Colin Morikawa, to me, is the prime example of this, a guy who is gaining more than a shot on the field per round with his approaches. And we have seen, when he has good putting weeks, as he did at the 2020 PGA Championship and again at the 2021 Open Championship, he's going to win. He's going to beat those great fields. Rory McIlroy, a guy who is perennially among the best drivers of the golf ball on the PGA Tour. When he has good putting weeks, I think back to Bay Hill a couple years ago. I think back to Wells Fargo this past year. I think back to the CJ Cup this past fall. Once he has great putting weeks, Rory McIlroy is probably going to win the tournament as well. This is an anomaly. Hideki Matsuyama finishing number one in the field. It is an anomaly. He is the 205th ranked putter on the PGA Tour. He is, by any metric, not a good putter. He has lost strokes to the field each of the last three seasons on the PGA Tour. That does not mean that he is not capable of producing 1, 2, 3, 4 great putting weeks throughout the course of the season. And if he does, yeah, he's probably going to be a multiple-time winner this season. He already is. Wouldn't surprise me at all, Rex, if he can put together one, maybe even two more victories this calendar year and really challenge for PGA Tour Player of the Year. As you mentioned, you are at the Amex. It's going to be a shootout. A lot of low scores. Ugh,
so many low scores.
Really good field, though, Rex.
People are going to hate it. Like, Twitter's just
going to
beat this place up so bad.
Unless John Rahm wins, and then everything will be restored and in good order. You got John Rahm in the field. You got Patrick Cantlay. I'm hoping secretly that they rekindle the duel that we saw, not just at the Tour Championship and throughout the FedEx Cup playoffs, but they even had a little head-to-head at Kapalua, where John Rahm finished second, losing in a historic shootout to Cameron Smith, while Cantlay finished fourth. So I'm hoping that they can continue that. You also have Matt Wolf, Scotty Scheffler, Sung Jae-im, Tony Finau, Taylor Gooch, who has been atop the FedEx Cup point standings now for a couple of weeks. What are you most interested in seeing this week?
I want to see how John Rahm comes out of. I mean, Maui was amazing when you consider how much time he had taken off. He had not hit a shot, at least in the United States on the PGA Tour in anger since the Ryder Cup. And I think after that long of a break, you would have thought that, okay, there would have been some sort of rust, that there would have been something that he would have had to work out.
He scoffed at that notion that he would be rusty.
Oh, he just scoffed at it. He's putting a new driver in play. I think he's putting a new 3-wood in play. I think he might be
a new driver, you say? A new driver.
Yes, 10.5 degrees stiff.
10.5 degree stiff.
Does that sound familiar to you?
I sure hope so.
That's right. I think all of those things was impressive. And look, there's nothing John has done that's not impressive. But it was also the kind of golf course that when I think of John Rahm's game, I actually, as much of a power player as he can be, and I certainly would put him in that category, I actually like him more on tight fairways that require a little bit more control. I'll go back to Torrey Pines. I mean, he was the golfer with, I would say, mentally the best game, but more so he was just controlling his golf ball in very, very difficult conditions. I mean, Torrey Pines for the U.S. Open, I think it proved itself once again. So that's what I want to see come back. I thought it was interesting, and I did a little bit of reporting today on this, is that he is on the policy board along with your boy Patrick Cantlay and Brooks Koepka. I'm sorry, that's not right. The Player Advisory Council, along with your boy Patrick Cantlay and Brooks Koepka. And I'm amazed how quickly he has matured into a role of, he's a leader on the PGA Tour now. Obviously, being world number one with a lot of things, but I still am very much impressed with everything he has done over the last year, which we know has been very trying. I mean, when you have two bouts of COVID and everything else that he went through, I think he came out of it in impressive fashion.
When did it become cool to be on the pack?
After Tiger and Phil. That was part of my report. That's the part that gets me. I mean, Rory was on the pack last year, and he was voted chairman, and now he goes to the policy board. JT has done it.
I mean, Spieth is on there.
Jordan has done it.
JT's been on there.
I can tell you that Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods were never on the policy board, and I'm almost positive neither one were ever on the Player Advisory Council. And whatever that means, you can read into it. I think Tripp Eisenhower went on today on Golf Central after me and spoke a little bit more eloquently about this, having been a former member of the pack. Back in their era, it was not the top players. They did not gravitate towards these roles as decision makers. They didn't gravitate towards any sort of leadership role whatsoever. I thought it was interesting last year when I asked Rory, it was at Torrey Pines, about running for chairman of the pack. And he spoke really well about the idea that, look, there's a lot of big decisions that the tour needs to make over the next few years. One of them, of course, is the strategic alliance between the DP World Tour and the PGA Tour. And he wanted to be part of those decisions. I think you're seeing that across the board. I mean, look, Brooks doesn't have much interest in anything other than the major championship.
He is by far, to me, the most interesting member of the pack.
Yeah. Like, he doesn't seem to care about anything other than picking on Bryson and winning major championships. So now this is all of a sudden going to mean something to him?
What do you think they're trying? Like, clearly they have an agenda. They're not doing it for the greater good. They're not all of a sudden good Samaritans. All these guys have agendas. They all have ulterior motives. What is it that the John Rahms and the Patrick Cantlays and the Brooks Koepkas of the world are trying to achieve by being a part of the 16-man pack?
I think there's enough things that happen on the PGA Tour. And I was talking with someone who's kind of close to Phil today, and he was telling me that Phil sort of lashed out at the idea of the green reading material, because, and this kind of goes to Phil's history, for the major championships, Phil had put so much energy into the idea that, okay, he wants to get to the majors, the Masters being the exception because we go there every year, but he would get to the other three major venues early, and he and Pels, they would map out the greens and essentially do what these green reading books did. I mean, he would come up with his own version of it. And then the green reading books were created and he didn't have to do that anymore. And Phil was angry at the idea that now I have to do this and spend more time away from my family. And that, to answer your question, that was a roundabout way of doing it. I think for players like a Brooks, or I would even say a Jordan or Justin Thomas, they want to be part of these decisions. They don't want to be on the outside complaining about it. Whereas Phil has been throughout the majority of his career, throughout all of his career, really, on the outside.
Phil is still doing it.
He's still doing it. And I don't think, and even in Brooks's case, I'm with you. He's the most fascinating person in all this, because I think he wants to have a say. He wants to have a little bit more knowledge of exactly what's going on with the PGA Tour. I think the best example recently is whatever happened between the PGA Tour and the players who wanted to play in the Saudi International. there was more than two dozen players that needed to get competing event releases. And the tour drug his feet and held the other, some of the players' feet to the fire. They had to add events. I think that rubs players the wrong way, and I think they want to start having a say about that.
GMAC and Paul Casey are part of the 2022 pack, and they are two players who will be venturing across the pond to play in the Saudi International. Rex, I'm going to put you on the spot. Four players have been selected by the player directors to run for PAC co-chairman. Does that mean they're going to be alongside Rory? How does this work? Rory still gets a term, doesn't he? Or is Rory out?
No, Rory's in. So Rory starts his, it's a two-year term as a player director at when you're elected. What happens every third year, just because of the timing, I think I have it right. It's like a leap year thing. They have to elect two co-chairs because two players are coming off the board at that time. So what they do is they do 1-1-2, 1-1-2. I think is how they do it. So yes, of those players who are going to be running for it, Billy Horschel,
Peter Melnotti, and Webb Simpson. Who's getting your pick?
I think Cantlay is definitely getting the pick. I think there's a lot of respect among players for him. I think he has shown.
Dude is very sharp, and he is just no BS.
And there's no BS, and I think a lot of players.
No time for politics.
Some of his comments last year at East Lake at the Tour Championship regarding the specifically the Player Impact Program, I think that resonated with a lot of guys where they started to understand that, yes, this might have a detrimental effect. And I think we've seen it. I think we're seeing it right now with whatever it is that Phil did to try to do it. I think the last two spots come down between Billy Horschel and Webb Simpson. Nothing against Peter Malnati. I just think that Billy Horschel has been a part of this process. He's been a part of the pack for a long time. As has Webb Simpson. So I think the other two votes come down to those two guys. But I think Patrick Cantlay is a lock.
That concludes Rex, the 2022 PAC discussion. Sorry on the that. Golf Central podcast presented by Callaway Golf. If you guys are still listening at this point, more power to you. We thank you for your service. This week, Rex, on the DP World Tour, do not call it the European Tour. It is not called the European Tour anymore. It's called the DP World Tour. That is going to take some getting used to. Rory McIlroy, your boy, kicking off his 2022. You're in the bag for Rory. You have made that well known. However, even you have been a little bit critical. I wouldn't say overly critical because that's not your nature when it comes to Rory. You've been a little bit critical of the way that Rory played in 2021, despite having two victories on the PGA Tour, had an opportunity to win in Dubai at the what was then known as the European Tour season finale, kicked that one away, and then finished 18th out of 20 players at the Hero World Challenge. With about a month to recharge, what are your realistic expectations for Rory, your boy, in 2022?
I don't think he rips a shirt this time. I feel like I'm safe saying
at this tournament
like
this shirt, or this year.
No, I'm going at this tournament this year. It could go either way. Look, I was critical because he was critical, because you go back to the Ryder Cup and all of the emotion that came spilling out on Sunday. And I think, again, this is heart of hearts time and trying to look into the soul of a man. In this particular case, I think he realized he had been too hard on himself over the course of the year. That, look, there are just certain things he can control, and certain things he cannot control. And sometimes I think Rory has a hard time distinguishing between those two things. And when you saw those emotions at the Ryder Cup on Sunday, after getting that victory, after by far his worst Ryder Cup ever, I mean, it was abysmal. I think he realized that
he got benched.
Yes.
Rory McIlroy on a terrible European team got benched. That's how bad it was going.
And I think he realized that he needed to cut himself a little bit of slack. That it's easy to beat yourself up. You pointed out he won multiple times last year.
He won twice.
And what's going to continue, if he doesn't find a way around this, it's just going to continue to manifest. That as he gets further and further away from his last major championship, as he gets closer and closer to Augusta National every year, it's only going to build. It's not going to get less. It's not as though things are just going to be whisked away. Anything other than a green jacket, it's just going to continue to fester. And he has to find a way to wrap, which is a very, very complicated and insightful mind. He's got to figure out a way to wrap that mind around it.
I still maintain, and I've probably said it a number of times in this podcast, I maintain that he is conflicted. He is conflicted because this dude used to be the baddest man in golf. He was the alpha dog. He was strutting and stunting all over the dudes on the PGA Tour. That's who he was in his early to mid 20s. And yet you look at him now on the other side of 30, trending towards 35. He is a dad. He is a husband. He is a well-adjusted adult, and he is grappling with how can this well-adjusted adult with this inquisitive mind and this thoughtful personality and really a gentle spirit, can he still access that inner dog that made him great, that earned him four major titles by the age of what, 24? Can he still access that player? That is the conflict he is finding. When he says that he's going back to the basics, Rex, that's great. And I think that is great for his mindset. Is that great for the actual X's and O's of his golf? Hitting that big, high, booming tee shot off the tee, yeah, that's probably going to help his golf. But the same driver swing that makes him so elite is also the reason why he has always been a pedestrian, if not below average, wedge player. With a guy hitting 330, you're going to have wedges all day until he can sharpen up that aspect with Michael Bannon. I'm still not sure. And so I'm going to pin this to you rapid fire. You have no idea this is coming to you, which is why this is going to be absolutely delightful. A series of rapid fire Rory questions for you. Ready, set, go. Rory's world ranking is currently number 8. Does he finish the year higher than that in terms of 1 through 7 or lower than that?
Higher than that.
You think he's going to be above world number 8? Why? And how high will he go?
Oh, I think he gets back into the top 5. I don't know about 1, 2, or 3. So I guess that just leaves 4 or 5 in my equation. However, I think that he has too much talent. That you can sit here, and these are supposed to be rapid fire, so I'm going as quickly as possible. But you can sit here and talk about, yes, he doesn't have the dog in him anymore. And there is something to that. I'm not denying. I'm not going to debate you on that. And I think that's what he was trying to manufacture in Dubai when he comically ripped his shirt off after kind of stumbling down the stretch.
Favorite moment of 2021 for sure.
I still think that makes me laugh in my head, just him struggling with the shirt and getting more and more angry as he kept doing it. But there's still too much talent. I think as he gets closer with Michael Bannon, as they go back to sort of the roots, I just saw when he won the PGA Championship at Kiawah, it's always stuck with me that he kept hitting driver over and over again, and he didn't have to. He was winning by a million. He did it because he could, and I love that idea, and that player is still inside of him.
John Rahm, Colin Morikawa, Dustin Johnson, Patrick Cantlay, Justin Thomas, you think Rory is going to crash that party?
I'm not so sure. Dustin Johnson, it leaves me with more questions. Now, if we turn that question, Johnson, yes, absolutely, yes.
But I also think Victor Hovland and Xander Schauffele, our pick to win the Masters, FYI, can make that leap as well. Rory, at the Masters, win top 5, top 10, or other. What do you got?
I'm going to go with other. I just think it's just going to continue to build. I mean, I don't know that.
He has a terrific record at Augusta National.
No, he has a fantastic record at Augusta National. I just think it's just going to get worse for him. It's just the questions, the idea that, look, this is the one thing that still separates him from the true greats in the game. I mean, winning the career Grand Slam is going to really push him over the top. Not that there's any debating right now that he was one of the best that ever played the game, but if he gets the career Grand Slam, that puts him in elite category, and I just think he knows it. He knows the game better than we do, dude. He sits and thinks about it much more than we do.
I don't know about that. We think about it a lot. Does Rory win a major in 2022? Yes or no?
No. Again, this just continues to fester and build. And I just don't – I mean, I guess St. Andrews would be the one that I would go to immediately. And he certainly has had success there. And you look at
– Stay away from the kickaboot.
Stay away from the kickaboot. Well, it's a combination. Stay away from the kickabout and stay away from the bad side of the weather draw, which got him the first time around. So, yeah, that would be the one that I would think he could do. Again, I just – he has so much pressure when he goes to Augusta. He has so much pressure now when he goes to the UK for one of those majors. It's going to be so hard.
Besides, Tiger's going to win the Open at St. Andrews, I've been told. So, unfortunately, Rory is going to be next out there. That's just what I've been told on the internet. Rory McIlroy, number of wins, 1.5, over, under.
Over. Yeah, I still like his chances week in and week out on the PGA Tour.
You think he's going to mop up at the Wells Fargo's and the CJ Cups of the world, but not actually the tournaments of significance?
Well, I guess if that's the way you want to put it, it seems like a very negative, half empty kind of way to put it. The problem is the Wells Fargo's not played at Quail Hollow, where he seems to own that place. So it's being relocated this year. I believe it's up in TPC.
Are they going back to Wilmington?
No, it's going to TPC up in Washington. I'm looking forward to that. It's my old stomping grounds, man.
Oh, I'm sure Roy would tear up a TPC, and I still think that tournament will be well attended. It's
what about the Players Championship? If he wins the Players Championship, is the major thing over? Can we call it?
No, because Roy won the Players Championship in 2019.
But that's two players. It's the argument is two players equals a major. No, can we not play that game?
We can. That's certainly a podcast for another time. Perhaps during Players Week, when we will inevitably question whether or not it is a major. Is there anything else you wanted to get into, Rex? Because I had something very important to get to.
No, I know what you want to get to. Yes, I had one more thing. And again, we did this on the Writer's Block to plug it one final time. And I found myself constrained in that particular format to talk about this. I don't think I
got it. We want more than 12 minutes.
It was Kevin Na and whatever happened between
him and Grayson Murray.
And you can go look it up. I don't want to spend a lot of time on background here. They got into a Twitter spat, and you and I were talking about this. And my take was, as much as I was entertained, as we all were entertained by Brooks and Bryson last year, whatever it is that was going on, I walked away from this one feeling a little dirty, feeling a little bad for Grayson Murray. We all know his bouts with mental health, and we all know that this has become an issue in sports that should be taken seriously, that we should talk about. And everyone sort of walked away, even Kevin, to a certain degree. I think he said earlier this week that he got a text from Brooks that said Brooks loved the tweets. And I don't like his ally in this particular conversation, because I just feel like, look, you don't want to come off being the bully. And in this particular case, Kevin Na was just defending himself, and I don't want to make him the victim here either. But I truly think that Grayson Murray, everything you know better than I do, Lab, because you have written extensively about this, the issues that he has had and the struggles that he has had. And I felt like this was a truly triggering event where, yes, he should absolutely stay off social media. His account should be shut down, never to be reopened again. But if you're going to get into a situation where you start punching down on someone, that always concerns me.
So I'll give you credit, because I literally did not even think of that context with Grayson Murray's bout with
depression. We talked about it on Writer's Block.
No, I'm saying I didn't even think of that context before we had this debate. And I think you make a lot of great points. Twitter is already a cesspool, and you throw in the fact of someone who has just come out of a rehab stint for alcoholism and has clearly been battling demons for a number of years, not just in 2021, but for a number of years. That is a toxic recipe. You wish that he would take a social media hiatus, get right, and come back to it. However, I mean, his agent has access to the account. They haven't deactivated it. Clearly, it's some sort of outlet for him. I will say, Kevin Na, he thinks his joke is really funny. Like, he is slapping himself on the back for saying, "Oh, you missed the cut is getting old too." I think it may have been deleted. Grayson's reply to that is, "You wouldn't be making cuts if they actually enforced the rule," which is actually pretty good too. Like, I don't think Grayson got as dunked on as people are making it out to be.
Well, and I also tried to come to Kevin's defense. Again, we were constrained to 12 minutes talking about everything that happened in the golf universe over the course of a week.
Unrealistic.
However, I would argue that Kevin is the example of why the PGA Tour's current pace of play policy has a sliver of light that it might work, because he is held up as an example by almost every official I talk to and plenty of players who feel like that, okay, he was clearly slow. He had a problem. And once they identified it and they got in his face, that he has tried to change it. Now, he's not perfect, and he's by far not the fastest.
Did you watch the opening round
on the PGA Tour? I was taken how slow the final group was on Sunday at Sony. Forget about Kevin Na.
Russell Henley is really slow.
That was painfully slow. At one point on the telecast, they said that they were just walking to the 15th, the last group. We're just walking to the 15th tee, and the second to last group was already on the 16th green. That's unacceptable. If we're really going to get into conversation.
On Sunday, I don't have a problem with it because the stakes are so significant, especially if they're in the same group. Argument. Let them take their time. On Thursday, for a dude who's trying to shoot 59, Kevin Na's pace of play was abysmal. It was embarrassing, and it should have been penalized. That's just a fact. It should have been penalized. He was taking more than 2 minutes to hit shots. That should never, ever happen, especially on a Thursday.
All right. Take it to Twitter, Grayson. What's your parting thought here? I think I know what you want to get into.
Well, of course I want to get into, since, you know, you obviously can't be barbecuing this week. You're in Palm Springs. You'll be having your 5 o'clock dinner with the rest of the population in Palm Springs and then hitting
I
the hay.
I ate at 5 o'clock tonight. It was very sad. That's why I had to hold off on the podcast till 5:30 my time.
And now it's 6:30. And as soon as we wrap this up, I'm sure we'll be hitting the hay just like literally everyone else in Palm Springs. However, you finally made the purchase. We talked about it last week. The Pit Barrel Cooker Jr. How did it go?
I went with spatchcock chicken, which I still feel uncomfortable saying that, but apparently that's the correct way of saying it. And it was the easiest thing I've ever done as far as smoking goes. Yeah, I've done a lot of ribs. I've done pulled pork. Tried to do a brisket once. It didn't come out very well.
Brisket's tough. Brisket's deceptively tough.
It was so easy. You just light it. I put the probes in, set the monitors. They let me know once the chicken got to 165. It was magical. It was.
I told you not to take it to 165. You got to take it to 158.
You know what? I actually went beyond 165 because I was being safe. Well, it's chicken. I don't think it's my first time. You don't want to mess around.
Yeah, you don't want to play with. You don't want to play with chicken. You really and like
salmon.
If you're handling raw chicken, like you better wash your hands. You wash your hands for about 30 seconds. If you've ever been chicken sick, you will never want to be chicken sick again. How did your family like it? They're always tough judges.
No, everyone was very happy. I left one of the chickens. I did two of them. I left one of the chickens for my wife. She was going to do some stuff with it this week. And then I pulled the other one and I made tacos for everyone. It was a huge hit. Even both of my younger son's girlfriends came over and they loved it as well.
Mm. So you really just hook the meat and hang it on the rebar.
You're hanging on the rebar. It's easy to light. Put a couple chunks of apple wood down at the bottom and it burned. I mean, lights out for
talk about chunks.
Yeah. I said chunks.
Yeah. Chunks. But, so, yeah, you did the lump charcoal. You like that. You threw the apple chunks.
I don't want to go too
there.
Deep here because again, we're getting off point with the broadcast, with the podcast. You actually fill the basket at the bottom up and then you only do a couple of pieces of the lump charcoal. You actually start those like in a separate chimney, and then you pour those on top and you let them burn down and that creates the fire going up. Yes. And
everything cooks between essentially 275 and 325, which if you're at home, that is the sweet spot. It's a spot where you're still going to get smoke flavor, but you're also not going to be tending the barbecue all day long. How long did that spatchcock chicken, Rex, take you to cook? I predicted about an hour and a half.
That would have been about it. I let it go probably another 20 or 30 minutes after that. It took one a little bit longer than the other. That's why and again, it was chicken. I couldn't mess around with chicken.
Did you rotate them?
I did rotate them. Yeah. And it's very easy to do. Like it was really, really straightforward. So I can't tell you how much easier it was than I had used a smoke box. We've talked about this before and that took so much work.
If you took the chicken breast past 165, I'm guessing that was a little bit dry. No, a little bit dry. Just a touch dry.
The breast wasn't dry at all. No. The breast wasn't dry at all because I had injected it, I think is why.
Oh, with butter.
With butter, a little bit of hot sauce, and a little bit of rub is what the recipe I said.
Oh, delish. Oh, it was chef's kiss.
Okay. So good. All right, what did you do this weekend for wild card weekend? Super wild card weekend.
It was freezing. You were in town. It was absolutely freezing on Saturday.
Take
so
it
I did
easy
smoke.
With us. People live up north. We still live in Florida. Take it easy.
Yep. So I did smoke chili. And I've been enjoying it for the last 3 or 4 days. It was absolutely delicious. I have done everything on the grills. They're getting a workout. Probably, I feel like my grills know that I'm heading on the road next week for the first time in about 3 or 4 months. So they know I'm going to put it through its paces. I've done steaks. I did shrimp. I did the chili. I've done chicken. I've done salmon. I did
time to go.
Sirahi tuna. I think I'm cooking every day. I think I'm cooking every day.
Is the wife? Yeah. Okay. But Ryan, it's time for you to go. Head to the airport. Your bag is packed.
we cannot afford pellets and or lump charcoal any longer.
So we're going to be doing the pod next week and you're going to be at tour.
Yes, I'll be there. We'll be doing Writer's Block. There's another shameless plug. Writer's Block recap. And
Sunday night. I actually have to catch a red eye Sunday night. So we're going to be up against it. So just so you know. Yes.
I guess we're going to have to figure that one out, won't we?
I've done the math. We should be fine. We only got 10 minutes, so it's not that hard of a deal.
12 if we're lucky for the recap pod, and then I'll be stuck in this position the following week coming home from Torrey Pines. I'm not sure, Rex. I was supposed to go to do golf today in Connecticut. I might be up at Pebble Beach doing golf today. I might be back in Orlando Studios doing golf today. Hell, I might be home in our home studio doing golf today. So I'm looking forward to seeing where my travels take me. Rex, enjoy the shootout and all the low scores, which are surely going to anger everyone on Twitter. Should be a great tournament at the American Express. I'll be keeping my eyes on Abu Dhabi and every other major tour that is in action. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Golf Central Podcast presented by Callaway Golf. We will be back next week, and trust me, we will not be keeping it to 10 to 12 minutes.